Okay, this hour we're going to take your phone calls with Nick Redfern and probably even your stories. Maybe you've been abducted. Check in with us on Coast to Coast AM. Calls are lining up for us, Nick, but tell us about the Dana Howard story.
Yeah, Dana Howard, one of the weird things about the contactee stories is that those who went public for the most part were men. I don't know why that is, because the cases involving women are no less significant, and arguably in some cases are more significant. But one of the women contactees who did go public with her story was Dana Howard. And what makes Dana Howard's story interesting was that her initial encounter actually occurred in 1939, when she talked about seeing this sort of very beautiful, as she described it, radiant woman in a wooded area, which sort of really caught her attention again, realized that there was something sort of ethereal and strange about her. And said that, and I'm just quoting from her now, she said that a beautiful rocket-shaped ship was suspended in midair about 300 feet from the Earth, which was obviously, you know, from where this particular being had come from. And again, she stressed several times that this was some sort of radiant being. Now, the initial encounter didn't last long, but in 1955, Dana Howard said that she had another encounter with this particular being. And interestingly enough, the encounter in the 50s had been prompted by her attendance at a seance, where she tried to, I guess, contact this particular being again in some sort of astral or alternative format. And lo and behold, this female space sister, if you like, appeared once again. But again, it goes to show that many of these cases, they weren't occurring in the fashion that I suppose most people assume them to occur. You know, a nuts and bolts spacecraft comes down. It was almost like an ethereal contact via distinctly alternative means. And that was perhaps typified more than any other with Dana Howard's case.
Very strange, all these cases. Mm. Very strange. Let's go to some calls. We'll pick it up by going to Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Bob, you're up with Nick Redfern.
Yes, two days before Thanksgiving, one of the most highly credentialed, respected scientists in the world, who is the director of science and the director of space research in Bulgaria, which is basically their version of NASA, released a statement that Bulgarian Academy of Science had completed a dialogue with extraterrestrials, 30 of them, in a media statement, and that they're friendly to us, and their next meeting will be in 2011. The next day, that article was changed to one about crop circles. His name is Lakhazar Filipov. That was changed to one about crop circles, which was not the original story. Since then, many people have been kind of worried about his safety because he went missing for 10 days. He came back, and now he won't talk to anybody. Now, imagine our director of NASA coming out and making a statement like that. In this country, because that's basically what it is. He's one of the most highly credentialed, respected scientists in the world. Now, I don't think these people are making this up. I think this is
something's
this is,
going on.
I do not think that any scientist like this would make this kind of a story up. And I don't know what's wrong with the mainstream media, but they refuse to report on this. But I do believe that it's a legitimate story. His name is Lakhazar Filipov. He was friends with Carl Sagan.
Have you heard of this fellow, Nick?
Yes, I have. You know, this is what, you know, when you said earlier, to what extent do, you know, contact cases go on to this day? This is one of the things that a lot of people forget or just don't realize, that, you know, the interactions with reported aliens today aren't just the classic kidnappings and abductions, that there are people still reporting direct interactions and even some sort of face-to-face liaison or contact, you know, with these beings. And I think that that's it, the important factor to remember. And, you know, when the caller said about the mainstream media not touching these stories, many of which are very credible, that's true. But I think also certain elements of the UFO research community are guilty of not touching them, because even they don't want to hear such controversial stories. And that's a shame because, you know, I've tried to point out that I do believe there's a genuine alien interaction going on, which we can perhaps learn a lot from if people, the right people, sit up and take notice. That's the important thing, I think.
Absolutely. What prompted you to write Contactee?
Well, more than anything else, I think it was the fact that in speaking to people, fellow researchers, colleagues, friends, even people at conferences, I found several key factors. One, that so many people who were well-versed in the UFO subject just assumed that the contactee stories were all hoaxes and the people were fakers or fantasists, etc. Another one was the notion that the subject really didn't have any great significance to the history of the UFO subject. And the third one was that really looking at these cases wasn't going to expand our knowledge of ufology. And I sort of vehemently disagreed with all those views when several years ago I began deeply immersing myself in the world of the contactees and found, you know, these distinct parallels between many cases. The fact that, you know, we could find deep parallels going back hundreds of years with different cases, the fact that the FBI were deeply concerned by many of these accounts and stories that the people were relating, and also the sheer scale of the movement, which, you know, as I said, galvanized so many people, changed so many lives, put them on a road where spiritually, you know, they felt enhanced and uplifted and took them away from their, quote, normal lives. And, you know, as I also touched upon, when you're selling 125,000 books and having 12,000 people at your conference, you are having an effect on the ufological world, whether or not people accept, you know, the views and the beliefs, etc. So it was a profound, particularly in the 50s, a profound period within ufology that attracted massive audiences. And I believe personally that, you know, the main reason I wrote is that many of these experiences were real. And I think it's kind of a shame that so many people won't touch them. And it's almost like a missing part of ufology today. So hopefully I've kind of tried to fill in the, you know, the missing pieces of the jigsaw, so to speak.
Okay, let's go to Aaron, Ashland, Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, long-time listener. I think your show is wonderful. So, I was just curious what your guest thinks about Alex Collier. A lot of talks on YouTube about him and, you know, all that good stuff. I think he's a wonderful person, in my opinion, but I was just wondering what your guest thinks about him and if he's studied that on him and...
Do you know this person, Nick?
Who's that, sorry?
His name is Alex Collier, and he's a contactee, supposedly.
Alex Collier.
You know, I don't actually know that name, no.
If you would, just check him out on YouTube and Google, you know, Alex Collier. And he's pretty big in the UFO field, from what I understand. He's does a lot of things with Project Campbell and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the important things is that there are so many contactees still around today, you know, that some of them, as I said, have become known as silent contactees who don't want to say too much. Others are sort of coming more to the fore. And it's very much not, you know, a phenomenon just of the late 40s, 50s, and 60s. As I said, unfortunately, I'm not acquainted with this particular person, but, you know, it serves perfectly to show that, you know, the movement is still thriving.
Let's go next to our wild card line in Greenville, South Carolina. Alexander, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, I'm a contactee. I was contacted on the 27th of August, 1952. I was contacted by a craft that was 30 feet in diameter, 10 feet high. It changed in colors from reddish, bluish white, bluish green, reddish orange, and bright glacier white amber. And on the side of the craft was the insignia like Lonnie Zamora had in Sirocco, New Mexico. And the craft on this, when it was in the egg shape, in the center of it, it seemed to be wobbling from side to side. And when it came into land, it gave off a bluish white flash of light. And when it took off, it gave off a bluish white flash of light. It's the odor of sulfur was in the air. The craft had three people. I've been under surveillance since 1952. I live here in Greenville, South Carolina. I used to live in Oceanside, New York. I knew Jim Moseley. I knew Tim Beckley. I knew John Keel. I knew the group down in Louisiana at Pascagoula. I heard about their case, the Hinkle family. You remember the story about this, the Mothman that broke out in 1952? I believe it was because they had encountered me on the 27th of August, 1952, because 2 weeks later, on the 12th of September, Kathleen May and her family had the encounter in Wheeling, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And that was the one about the Silver Bridge in West Virginia between the Ohio River and Wheeling, West Virginia.
This contact continue, Alexander?
Well, actually, what they do now is they communicate with me by telepathy. They used to, they did a telepathy when it landed because they told me to keep my distance. And I signaled the craft, and the craft signaled me. I signaled a dash and two dots in Morse code, a hesitation, and then all of a sudden the egg lit up in an amber color three times. I have a friend somewhere out in outer space. By the way, I met a woman named Princess Moonow and Viv DeVenus in 1967 at the Flying Saucer Convention in New York City at the Commodore Hotel. And I knew Betty Hill. I knew all the people in the UFO field.
Yeah, you know all the players there, Alexander. Mm-hmm. So, Nick, what do you think of stories like this? How do they fit into some of the things you've researched?
Well, you know, I'm very pleased that Alexander called in because this is like a classic definitive contactee Space Brother story. You know, and you asked the question earlier, is this something that was simply of the past, so to speak, and, you know, how many of these people are there out there? Alexander's story just serves to show us that there are many people, even listening to this show, who've had these definitive experiences that easily parallel the likes of George Adamski and George Van Tassel, but perhaps not on the scale of, you know, where we're all aware of the accounts. And I think, you know, Alexander's is an important one because it does contain key and integral facets of the contactee mystery. And, you know, I'm kind of intrigued too by the whole issue of being contacted by telepathy, which is something that, for example, George Adamski talked about, that he said that the aliens he met were mute, and it was via, as it was described, thought transfers, as George Van Tassel also described it, how the interactions progressed. So, you know, this to me is all kind of encouraging that we're dealing with a genuine phenomenon, and there are just, you know, countless people out there like Alexander who've got stories to tell, and, you know, fascinating accounts of meeting some of the early players in the subject as well.
Okay, very good. Next up, we go to our first time caller, Grant in Ventura, California. Hey, Grant, go ahead.
Hi. Let me turn off Siri. Give me 2 seconds.
Sure thing.
Are you there?
There you go. Okay.
So I have been near Integratron, and I have several of you who live in the area have told me the story that he actually finished the Integratron, and it had to do with crystals placed strategically. But he got it up and running once, and then the FBI came and took the crystals. I was just wondering if you or your guest had heard of that story, or that was my question.
Okay. I'm not, unfortunately, Grant, aware of the FBI actually confiscating anything, but I can tell you for absolute certainty that the FBI did visit Van Tassel on several occasions and even infiltrated covertly undercover his conferences and lectures. So, in other words, he was no stranger to the FBI. You can now get his FBI file through the terms of the Freedom of Information Act, which is 398 pages long. Now, you know, when you read it and you find the extent to which he was being watched, which covered 1952 to 65, you know, 13 years of constant surveillance. That's a lot of time, money, and manpower being spent. So the possibility that there could have been extra things going on that actually aren't mentioned in the declassified files isn't out of the question. We know, for example, that the FBI were involved in one aspect of George Adamski's story where those files haven't been released. Other FBI files on Adamski have. So it's not out of the question at all that this deep connection between Van Tassel and the FBI hasn't been fully resolved yet.
Okay. Well, that was my question, and I appreciate your time, and thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Now, Nick, tell me a little bit about how you think history should remember these contactees.
Well, I think we should remember them in several ways. One, you know, if you look at it purely from a psychological level, these are people who lived lives that, in some respects, you know, they weren't satisfied with for reasons whether they knew it or not. And they really sort of propelled themselves into new lives, took on, once they knew identities, but who really transformed themselves radically at personal levels from a positive, almost like spiritual perspective or cosmological perspective. They developed deep followings. They had, you know, literally thousands of people who hung on their every word. Now, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing when you look at the world of politics and how people are manipulated. But I do think that the vast majority of the contactees were basically people who believed the ideology and that they were putting across. And, you know, we should remember them as people who did that successfully, who galvanized so many people to follow them, created a movement that lasted for decades and still continues, albeit to some extent under the radar today. And whether we believe their stories, as I do, a lot of them, or for people who don't believe them, we still have to realize that at a sociological and historic level, they were a big part of the UFO subject. There's absolutely no doubt about that at all. They weren't a minor cog in the wheel, so to speak. They were really at the forefront.
Well, that's very true. Where do you get your book, Contactee?
Well, Contactees is published by New Page Books. It's available at all good online bookstores and, you know, bookshops as well. It was published, actually, just earlier this month, the official publication date. So it's literally brand new.
Nothing like a brand new book, Nicholas.
There you go.
I love it. And what's new for you? Any more conferences coming up?
Yeah, I'm speaking at one in New York next month. And I think it's the weekend of the 8th or the 9th.
You post that on your website?
Yes, the information's on my website. I kind of had a blanked out moment then remembering exactly when and where it is. But if people go to nickredfern.com, the link is on there to the conference.
All right, let's come back with final phone calls for you, Nick. Nick Redfern, right here on Coast to Coast AM with your calls. We'll be back. Well, next hour, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment, followed by some of your calls with Joshua. But when we come back, we're going to take final phone calls with Nick Redfern right here on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, the contactees of the past, the Adamskis, the Van Tessels, they have stories that they seem to be so incredible compared to the abductee cases of today where, you know, they talk about feeling like they're being probed or they're in some kind of a crap. Why the big disparity there?
Well, you know, that's actually a very good question. It's almost as if the phenomenon itself has changed in some respects. And, of course, you know, this is one of the reasons why some people get kind of concerned about the nature of the phenomenon, that possibly in some way or other it's deceptive in that, you know, on the one hand, it's presented as kindly, long-haired space brothers, and then it's these ominous, cold-hearted, emotionless greys kidnapping people. And, you know, the theory has been put forward, well, is it all the same intelligence presenting itself in different ways to determine the human reaction and response, like a fight or flight type of scenario? Or, you know, we could ascribe different motivations to different intelligent beings in the same way that people of Earth, you know, we all have different plans and goals in life. Maybe there's something like that. What I would say is that, you know, if you look at the abductions, they seem to pretty much, not for the most part, but certainly come out of the woodwork, so to speak, in the 60s onwards. And it seems to me that if we're dealing with physical 3D beings, that the Space Brothers were more of like a smaller select band that were perhaps taking an alternative route to getting information out there and liaising with the public, and that the Greys were, you know, completely separate to them in some respects. So.
Okay, and back to the calls we go. Rio Grande City in Texas. Chris, it's your turn with Nick Redfern. Go ahead, Chris.
George, how you doing?
Okay, Chris.
It's an honor and a privilege to talk to you. I'm a long, long time listener.
Thank you.
And to your esteemed guest, thank you. My question was, has anybody ever put forth the notion that maybe one of these contactees made such a good impression on whomever was contacting them that maybe there's somebody out there in the universe looking out for us? Because, you know, it's a pretty violent universe.
Mm.
You know, maybe somebody's actually, you know, mm-hmm. looked at us and said, hey, maybe we got potential. Has anybody ever, you know, asked that to, you know, of the contactees?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that certainly does come out in a lot of the writings and lectures of the contactees, that they felt that the whole reason why these beings were coming down was because they did care enough to look after us in some respects, or try and teach us how to, you know, better our place in the universe. So it wasn't so much like a self-serving reason for coming down. They actually did have our best interests at heart. Now, as I said, that's sort of reflected in the writing, certainly, of people like Adamski and Van Tassel. Of course, the big question is, you know, how do you help someone without flooding and overwhelming their society with yours? And I think that's something that is pointed out very well in the works of the contactees, where they point out that these intelligences do seem, as you said, to be looking out for us, want to help us, but don't seem to want to do it from the perspective of, you know, a large-scale invasion, not in a sinister sense, but an invasion of where they literally transform and carve out a new society for us. They care enough to allow us to do it ourselves, but with a few pointers from them.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you for your time. Thanks for the show, George. Great.
Okay, Chris. Appreciate you being part of the show for so long. Next up, we go to Washington, D.C. Mason, you're up. Go ahead, Mason.
Hi, George. Hi, Nick. How are you tonight?
Hey, Mason.
Good. So I was abducted in June 3rd, 1963. And they downloaded me with a lot of information, one being Executive Order 11110, which would put the Federal Reserve Bank out of business. And on June 4th, 1963, John F. Kennedy, our president, signed that executive order. And this has never been repealed. It's still valid. It will save the United States of America as we know it. As we see President Obama coming out today saying, U.S. will go bankrupt without health care. Now, Executive Order 11110 will give us silver-backed currency and will save our country. And bottom line, will stop this illegal Federal Reserve Bank from being in business. Now, chemtrails are another thing with global warming that was downloaded. And now I see it being sprayed every day. Now, this goes to a atmospheric testing called the Variable Terrain Radioparabolic Equation Model and VTRPE. Now, the Air Force Institute of Technology at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is involved with this project. Now, when the aliens abducted me, they downloaded all this information. And when you talk about a savior, I feel like they have asked me to come and save our country with Executive Order 11110 and hopefully Barry Satoru, this president that the people have elected, but he has not shown documentation such as his passport, his birth certificate, kindergarten records, his Occidental College records, Columbia University's records.
Okay, I think you're off topic a little bit. That happens, Nick. You know that?
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the caller made a very valid point. The fact that when his experience occurred, that it was like he felt he'd been put on a mission. And that's something that we don't just get in contactee cases, but in some abductee cases as well. The idea that, you know, it isn't just a one-sided thing where they take us for, you know, scientific or medical reasons or whatever, but they instill like a guiding motivation and put us on a path.
How do we know, though, that he's not like self-appointed? That you know, he's just
well,
some
you know,
guy
I mean,
got
I
his
think
own
that,
mission.
I don't doubt that happens. You know, I'm quite sure psychologically that has happened. I just find it very intriguing that so many people in this distinctly, I guess, you know, specific field, all felt compelled to do something because an outside force had driven them to do it. You know, if it was one or two people, I think you could go down the self-appointed angle. But when you find a whole movement of people in cultures and countries all around the world, all being, I won't say programmed, that's a little bit too cold and clinical, but prompted and actually taking up the challenge, I find it intriguing that we have parallels with this all around the world.
Next up, we go to Andy in Los Angeles. Thanks for holding, Andy. Go ahead.
Hi. Great show. And Nick, I really enjoy your commentaries. First of all, I spoke to the great astrophysicist many years ago who was in charge of Blue Book. And I asked him what were the chances of there not being life on other planets on a Chicago radio station. And his response was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I'm going to ask you the question, do you believe, two-part question, do you believe that, number one, that we are dealing with interdimensional beings that are able to come in and out of our reality, or are they just like us, living on a planet and carrying on with their daily lives? And number two, have you ever heard of any contactees from various, let's say, Christian or other religions, who are strong believers in God and Jesus Christ or Buddha or whatever, who were also affected by this in a negative or positive way? And I'm interested in that commentary.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you know, as far as the, you know, the first part of the question is concerned, I think when we talk about aliens, my view is that we're dealing with something that is definitively non-human. I think the big question of whether they're literally extraterrestrial or, as some people feel, you know, interdimensional or something along those lines, I think it's a valid area of research, because if you look at the contactees, a lot of their experiences did occur in kind of altered states where, for example, you know, some of them, as I said, engage the so-called aliens in conversation at seances and with Ouija boards. George Hunt Williamson, a very famous contactee, many of his early encounters were reportedly with Ouija boards. So, you know, you wouldn't imagine that would be reflected in a nuts and bolts encounter with a literal alien from another planet. So, you know, I think we could be dealing with other planes of reality that can shift in and out of ours, and maybe we can kind of call them up almost, and vice versa. Now, as far as the second part of the question is concerned, it really depends, I think, on the individual. I mean, a lot of mainstream religions are sort of embracing the idea that it's okay to believe in aliens, particularly the Catholic Church in recent years. And they're taking like a very positive stance in saying that it doesn't, from their perspective, affect their religion if life exists on other worlds. Now, in saying that, there are other people who, I guess, take more an extreme view, the idea that, you know, the whole UFO mystery is like a satanic deception, you know, and it's not aliens, it's actually sort of gearing up for Armageddon, and we're going to be lulled into a false deception by these demonic beings, rather which we perceive as alien. Now, you know, so you have both ends of the spectrum, and I think, you know, anything that kind of combines or discusses aliens in conjunction with religion is inevitably going to polarize people into different camps, you know, along those lines.
Okay, we go to Jaden in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jaden, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Nick. And hi, George. George, I've listened to you for a really long time, and it was wonderful finding your show because I actually found, you know, it, for me, right, like somebody that was telling my story. I was contacted in 1984. I lived way out in the woods on the outskirts of Lane County outside of Eugene, way out in the forest. And this being, it definitely had no craft, so it would be something more interdimensional. And I'm trying to find out if Nick, if you had any stories like this, because I haven't ran across too many. The being, it was like red in color, didn't have a mouth. I mean, you could imagine E.T., you know, the character in the movie, but more human shape and size, only about 4 feet tall, and then it appeared, and then it reappeared. And I'm not going to get too far into my story, but the closest that I've ever heard somebody talk about that was one of George's guests back in about 2005, and he was talking about Satan, and it was an interdimensional being of a red-colored nature, and that's the only story that I really felt like has connected to me, only this being wasn't evil at all. Mm-hmm. So
I'm not, unfortunately, aware of similar beings, but what I can say is that there are countless reports on record where people have had encounters like this in isolated, out-of-the-way locations, such as forests. You know, I could reel off a whole range of sightings that are classically fall into that category. And, you know, I don't think this is purely down to chance or coincidence. I think specifically out-of-the-way locations where there's not going to be a lot of people, you know, dense forests, etc., are specifically chosen. Now, there's one particular case that I investigated at a forest in England called the Cannock Chase, where there's been a lot of strange activity of a UFO nature for years. It's a large area of woodland. I investigated one case from 1992 where a man was walking through the woods, saw this strange fog-like substance appear, felt disorientated, and then saw these typical space brother type aliens appear. But there wasn't a craft. It was just like a manifestation of advanced beings. So that's kind of similar, yet on the other side of the world. Obviously, the beings were different, not as you described them, but the scenario was very similar, at least.
Okay, Joe in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Waning moments here. Go ahead, Joseph.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Given the topic today, I don't talk too much about this, but I thought I'd share my abduction story with 4 million of my closest friends.
Okay, take it away.
What part would you like to know, leading up or the discussions we had or the medical experiments, what they wanted to do? I was 12 years old babysitting my four or five brothers and sisters one evening back in 1966. And it was very traumatic, as has been discussed in many other stories. I was the last one actually captured because there was quite a scramble, mad scramble, everybody running every way. And it was the blues that took us out. It was a gray story. So this being says to me, he tells me I've got to settle down or they're going to have to settle me down because it's going to be very dangerous for me. And long story short, they finally agreed to talk to me and tell me who they were and some stuff about themselves on condition that I would settle down. So I had about an hour's discussion with them. And, of course, I didn't remember one single thing for about 30 years.
Wow. That's an incredible story.
And that's actually quite typical, again, where the aliens feel compelled to engage people in conversation. You know, they don't need to, but they feel that, you know, it's helpful to do so. You know, this is a case where, you know, obviously there's an abduction angle to it, but also a contact, you know, an interaction angle, which is kind of interesting because, you know, you don't always get that. It's often one or the other. So this is more like, you know, some of the cases I mentioned earlier that straddle abductions and contact stories.
Where do you think they're coming from, Nick? They're various races. Mm. And how do you think they found us? I guess we're developing technology now where we find Earth-like planets. So I assume they make the assumption there must be inhabitants. Yeah. Let's go through the wormhole and we'll go there.
Yeah, I think my personal view is that I don't think they found us at random by simply, you know, as we do right now for the most
scanning
part, flying
the universe
around looking for things. Right. I think there has to be a technology or a science that allows for almost instantaneous travel, because that just makes it so much easier. You know, the sheer barriers involved in just hoping, flying X number of years to one star system, hoping to find something, I don't think that's feasible, even for an advanced alien race. I think it's more likely they found a way around linear travel, and that's what's made it much easier. As far as where specifically they're coming from, you know, I mean, if we look at it from a scientific perspective, any sort of, I guess, you know, a planet of acceptable size where there's a sun, a star system, etc., is going to do the job. I think, you know, people, I won't say deceiving themselves, but, you know, if people think they've got the full answers to where they're coming from, I don't think they do. Certainly, we're told certain points of origin, which could be true. Maybe that's the aliens protecting themselves. Maybe they're being honest. We don't know. But, you know, they're not locals, put it that way. But I would sort of hesitate to, you know, say point A or point B. I don't think we're that far into it even now to have a full understanding of that question.
It is a remarkable phenomenon, isn't it, Nick?
Oh, it is. You know, I mean, contact, alien contact, and the idea of interaction is arguably one of the most controversial of the entire UFO subject. You know, a radar report, close encounter, a sighting is fascinating in itself. To have someone who claims to have actually met, interacted, and philosophized, if you like, with aliens takes it to a whole new level. And, you know, that's what I've tried to get across, is that these are significant events. We shouldn't ignore them. We should embrace them and see what we can learn from them.
How do people get a hold of you, Nick Redfern, if they need to email you? Can they through your website?
Yes, nickredfern.com. There's a section there where people can email me direct. And, you know, I always try and answer within a day or so. I don't like to keep people hanging on. So.
All right, very good. Nick, thanks so much. Great show tonight with you.
Thanks a lot, George. Thank you.
Nick Redfern, his website, nickredfern, all one word, .com. Up next, Joshua P. Warren and his paranormal moment. We'll take phone calls with Joshua P. in the latter half of the hour, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We will be right back.